subject to experience. We laid out the philosophy of the Samkhya on one occasion, if you remember, and just state it again. We have the absolute here. And then on this side, we put the self. You may remember the term we use, the purusha, which is literally the city dweller. And the city in which it dwells belongs to the root substance from which the whole universe evolves. And the essential part to realize is that everything on this side of the line is material. This prakriti itself is made of the root, the basic create, defined in the Latin for creation, and the Greek concept of kara, the creator, the mixing bowl of being. This implies a rotation principle. This implies the working of that thing to close itself. This is the establishment. So the glyph of the prakriti is the circle with a cross in it, which we use as the sign of the earth, matter. The first evolutive prakriti is mahat, which is cosmic intellect. Mahat means the great intellect, as opposed to the individual intellect of any single man. So that Mahat itself is already a material entity. It is not immaterial. The self, Purusha, is spirit. And we said before that spirit, non-circulating, is not called soul, but if the spirit that translates turns and locks itself up, it is called soul. We can put cell in there, C-E-L-L with the F on the end, or solo with the U in for the power. The whole of this side is the pure subject, and it does nothing whatever except observe. And we've said that consciousness itself is a catalyst. Things happen in the material world when they are observed by an intelligence. Now we have to notice that the whole of the material side of evolution is not itself sentient. It is not intelligent. It is only by reflecting the self in the material that it appears to be intelligent. So the individual intellect we call buddhi, whence Buddha gets his title, and then coming down from there, manas, which is the mind that Western science uses, and therefore we have to distinguish very, very carefully between intellect, which deals with the a priori rational process, which is reasoning from first geometrical principles, and the manas, or mind, which has five internal organs in the mind, five external organs, which you know as eyes, ears, nose, etc., and five orders of stimuli coming to meet them. You know that Kant proved, to his own satisfaction, that the reason can never know anything other than the ratio of stimuli to the sense organs. It can never go beyond the material fact. So if we now say somewhere down here is an object called the material world, and it gives us on our sense organs five orders of stimuli from which we derive sight, taste, smell, touch and hearing, the external objects, the eye, the ear, etc., have corresponding centers separate in the brain. And the fact that these are separate in the brain and yet can be coordinated by act of will shows a unity principle behind. This used to be called the common sense, the sense common to the five. This is the manas. And this already is a material. The manas, the mind, is already a fine material relative to the gross material of the external sense organs. But, nevertheless, nothing happens in the mind except the changes induced by stimuli from the five senses. So, if the intellect turns to evaluate things that go on in the mind, it can never evaluate and produce conclusions other than those which point back to sense stimuli. So there's a closed circle inside the material world. This is the ring pass knot of the occultists. You can see that if we have a physical body which responds to stimuli, we know we have that by personal experience, and if the five senses can be coordinated, it demonstrates the existence of a unifying principle. This unifying principle can have nothing in it other than the reactions to the stimuli. The stimuli go in and the mind reacts. So somewhere in the zone of the mind stuff itself is all the problem of the knowledge of ordinary man. But above this principle of the mind that simply coordinates the five senses, there is a principle, the intellect, and this intellect has the power to reason upon metaphysical problems for which no empirical experience has been had from the five sense world. This we do, as we said before, by thinking in geometrical terms, like Plato and Pythagoras asked us to do. And when we do so, we find that although the reason is itself a material thing, nevertheless the material world is made of gross material objects, finer ones in the sense organs, finer still in the internal organs in the mind, a fine substance called the mind itself, citta is the Sanskrit term for it, and above that the determinative faculty, which decides precisely the nature of the relation between these senses and their stimuli. If I hold that with my finger and thumb and press, the contact that I get, the sense of touch, convinces me that there is something resisting me. And at the same time, if I look at it, my visual sensation is coordinated with my tactile sensation, and I make a decision in the intellect that these two stimuli belong to the same source. I have then coordinated the sense of sight and touch. Then I can decide what to do about it, whether to use it or leave it. And the determinative faculty, the part that determines what we shall do, is this intellect. And it has these two aspects. One, looking downwards towards the common sense, which coordinates the five senses, one looking upwards towards the very principle of matter itself. Now we said that if a force is translating and never turns upon itself, it cannot make anything. The idea of make, of MK, is the idea of a substance locked. MK means substance locked, so if we write the word make, we can see the makula, the spot, that comes in the cosmic Mary. The immaculate is the unspotted, and making implies locking. A force translating locks nothing. But a force turning upon itself and involving itself is making. So when it refers to the Virgin Mary's cosmic equivalent as makeless, it means spotless, meaning without turn in it, the forces and the vibrations of infinity translating, not turning upon themselves, are called mateless or immaculate. So, when we come to look at this side of the diagram, we're concerned with the object of consciousness. We know it has various aspects because one of its aspects is it offers resistance to the sense of touch. Now, the only way we can get a resistance is by first establishing a force. And the only way to establish a force is to make it rotate. If a force is allowed to translate, infinitely, it does not resist you. But if you cause the force to rotate, then it resists an attack from outside. So we know that matter is simply the rotation of force. If we remember our rota, the old anagram of the Torah, the great law, and the Torah of the Bohemians, it's all in the same conception. The idea of the circulation of force causing apparent solidity. Now, if we put in here a nucleus and an electron running around that nucleus, the electron goes down there so very, very fast that if we tried to stick a slow-moving particle into it, the electron travels down so quickly it comes back before the particle has gone across its orbit and is knocked out. So although the inside of the atom is apparently solid, that solidity is merely apparent. Apparent actually means derived from rotation. That's the pira in appearance, the pi ratio or function of this rotation. So all solidity is really the velocity of rotation. You know, if you spin a bicycle wheel, and when it's going very fast, you try to put your finger through it, you will have trouble with the end of your finger. The wheel will apparently be solid to you. You have to move very, very quickly to shoot through the spokes of a rotating wheel. So that solidity is really velocity of rotation. We'll come back later to see just why solidity is really the same thing as emptiness. Meanwhile, we know that the atom is almost entirely space. There's some nuclear substance, protonic and electronic, and around it some attendant electrons. But colossal amounts of space relative to the size of the electron. Just as in the solar system, there is a terrific amount of space relative to the size of the planets going around the central sun. This is the meaning of the Buddhist concept of the void, that most of being is empty. And we said before that void, empty, and vacuum, etymologically, all mean leisure. They do not correspond to the popular idea of voidity, of nothingness. It means power, non-manifesting. Power at leisure. In between the electron and the proton, in a hydrogen atom, we have space. And this space is not susceptible of electronic analysis, because the space between is much finer. The electron itself is a little rotation. And in between is the field, and the field is finer than this electron. If we said the gross electron corresponds with one of the bhutas of the Indian analysis, then the tanmatras, the fine elements, are in this field. The field is force, but the force inside the field is not electronic. There is a field round the electron very much finer than the electron itself. So there is gross matter corresponding to the source of the stimulus down here, and in the field here corresponds to that aspect in the mind that we call feeling. Feeling is field consciousness. Contact is act with. The tact is again the touch concept. And if we do two rotation systems, where they touch, that is the concept of contact, where they act on each other. That is the act, which is the force, pin, and the con with, and the T, the crossing. And it's this crossing act, T act, from which we get the word tactile, the sense of touch. So here, when we come to consider the material world, we are necessarily considering rotations of forces, which forces, if they cease to rotate, translate and receive a new title. Every time we change the name, we change the function. So if we change the function, we must change the name. So if the name of this is rota, or tura, law, this cannot be called law. This is said to transcend law. And every circulation of force has beyond it a translating force. That translating force itself may be a bigger circle, but relative to this one, it is a translation. If there is a big circle cutting this one and completing itself, where it crosses the smaller circle, it is a translating force, not a rotating force. So, in fact, the translating forces of solar energy going through the solar system are really rotating. They are spinning from the sun and going out and continuously returning in this manner, positively and negatively. And yet, from the point of view of the Earth, the energies from the sun are translating 93 million miles and being picked up on the Earth through the photosynthetic action of plants. So when we consider the material side of being, the existent side, the sixfold side of the rotation, we are considering a closed system, and for that we use the letter M. And we use the letter O to symbolize all of it. So if we put the vibrations in here in the form of M, there is O and there is M. And the Om signifies then the objective reality in consciousness. This then is the object, and this is the subject. Now there is a very old Indian saying to the effect that the self has never yet been in trouble. The body has never been out of trouble. Therefore, what does salvation mean? Your body has always been in trouble and can never get out. Yourself has never been in trouble. Therefore, what does salvation mean? You cannot save the body. The self doesn't need saving. What then is the meaning of salvation? The answer is it means washing. What you have to wash away is the rubbish that shrouds the self. Tearing the objective world a bit and dropping that. And we'll see what happens. The root substance of the universe has three phases. This is sometimes called the law of three. I'll put down because it always helps to have a term. We haven't got the terms in English. It's no good saying positive, negative and neutral because its electrical connotations would fool us. We have to take a glyph for inertia. The function is TM and the Sanskrit word for it is Tamas. And another function, Rajas. Now these are exactly opposite. This means inertia, dullness, darkness. This means the will to rule, Rajasu. This means ruling affirmation issue. So here we have two temperaments that we find on Earth, the inertic, the dull, the tamas, this one. The new gospel of Tamas is coming into its own at the moment, because Tamas is the doubter, the man who is not sure of himself, the dullard. He is the man who puts his finger in the hole to see that it really is there. And he has a real value because all empirical science is based on research of that order. Instead of trusting, instead of believing, as Christ says, blessed is he who, having seen, believes, and more blessed he who has not seen. Now the one who insists on seeing in order to believe is sticking his inertic finger, his gross material, into more gross material and moving it about until there's a bang. And when there's a big bang, he then says, lo, there was power involved into that matter. And the evidence is in the explosion. So the tamasic means inertia. And inertia doesn't mean simply lying down doing nothing. It also means doing the same thing over and over again. When you're in a bus going along and the bus driver brakes suddenly to avoid a pussycat, the bus stops, and all the people standing in the bus don't stop. They carry on rushing forward at about 35 miles an hour and rub their noses on the back of the driver's neck. In the process, they are demonstrating the existence of inertia. Inertia means in work affirmation. Whatever you are doing, if you can't stop it at will, it is inertia. Doesn't matter what it is, even if it's writing a thesis for a PhD, if you can't stop, you're suffering from mental inertia. Now, the whole of the inertia side of your being is the side that mechanically goes on doing and saying the same old things. This inertia is the enemy, because That inertia is simply involved will from previous activities. It is will that has become unconscious. And in the fact of it becoming unconscious, it has gone outside the field of possible control. Now, on the other side, we have the man who is affirming Ya, the Ra, the ruling activity. He is a spirit that affirms ruling activity. So Radias means precisely this will to rule, to dominate. There can be a will to dominate oneself. There can be a will to dominate other people. Now, in the world, we find, in general, two kinds of people, the inertic and the rajasic. The inertic ones are, in general, equated with workers of the ordinary kind, because they haven't got a lot of initiative. The rajasic ones are those ambitious businessmen that go about employing the inertic ones and having trouble with the inertia of the inertic ones. And if they hadn't got the inertia, they wouldn't work for the rajasic type in any case. So over here we'll put the ruling impulse. And we can see that between these two, if there were no third, there would be no hope at all for a proper relation inside the human body. If we place tamas on the stomach, and the man who sits deli pushing large numbers of post-toasties into the tum, with his eyes drooping and refusing to get up, and every now and then getting annoyed because there's not enough, he is tamasic, and another fellow who keeps shouting out, it's time you were at work, and I've got 20% backing on you, and I want the return, there's no relating factor between them. And unfortunately for the rajasic man who wants to rule, there are only two things he can rule. That is people weaker than himself, and himself if he's strong enough. And a very old saying says, great is he who can rule a city of tamasic beings, but greater still is he who can rule himself, because he would have to control his tendency to want to rule, which is tremendously difficult. And yet, in fact, we see these two types, those who wish to rule and those who don't, the inertic kind, the bread and circuses kind, and the others with the initiative. Now, unless a person comes out of the tamasic, inertic state and begins to want to rule, he cannot find a third thing. He will just be locked in the tamas. So, when we find a person with a desire to rule, even if initially it is simply a desire to rule the inertic ones, nevertheless it is the first sign that that being is on the way to ruling itself. And it will never rule the inertic ones properly until it can rule its own inertia internally. We've said before that the microcosm, the little man, and the macrocosm, the big man, have exactly the same kind of relations. Whatever is inside macrocosm is inside microcosm. Whatever is in man is everywhere, and what is not in man is nowhere. And if it were somewhere not in man, it would be unknowable to man, so that he could afford to forget about it. So, when a man becomes active and starts trying to rule the material, if he wants to go to work to see that these inertic beings are working, he'll have to rule himself out of bed first. I heard a funny thing the other day that businessmen have now started to go to work early because of the difficulties of parking their cars. Because if they don't go early, there's no parking space. So their determination to rule, unless they're going to bribe the keeper of the parking place, will get them out of bed earlier. They must overcome their own physical inertias before they can control the physical inertias of other beings. Now, in the process of the action and reaction between these two, the third state emerges. When the ruling impulses are directed against matter, matter always resists, and the ruling impulse continuously has to devise a method of trapping the inertic person into doing some work. And there are only two ways, the stick and the carrot. You promise him wages for his Friday night whoopee, and you use a stick and threaten him if he doesn't earn his wages. And these two methods have advantages and drawbacks. So that when the rajasic person is acting directly upon the inertic substance, of that being, it is resisting him. To every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction, which is why we get things like trade unions, which are really created not by the inertic beings themselves, because they couldn't do it, but by the demands of the employers upon them exceeding that which they are prepared to give. He, this individual man of initiative, forces these into group activity, because only in group activity can they derive sufficient strength to equal his individual activity. So he creates in the inertic a reaction, and between the two there then arises this third possibility. And that third possibility is called sattva. Now, sattva. Sat is being and belongs to tamas. Va is going and belongs to rajas. So sattva actually means being and going. It means inertia and initiative. This V itself means development, initiative. So the sattvic state is the state of pure balance between an impulse attempting to rule and an inertic reaction. So therefore, when we come to look at the self and see what salvation means, we discover that the true nature of the self is sattvic. That is, the self is a balance prior to creation of being initiative. A man like Vijayev says spirit means form of initiative. That is va, to go, initiative. And sat is being. And the true self is sattvic in its essence. Sattva is not an attribute to the self. The self is this pure sattva. And nevertheless, when the rotations of force produce, by continuous combinations of the fine elements into the gross, the atoms, the molecules, and complex bodies, with a continuous increase of inertia, then tamas is going. And any attempt on the part of the va principle that belongs there to act upon the inertic substances of its own organism produces a reaction from the organism with a consequent obscuration of this balanced condition. So that the self, which was never lost, becomes obscured by the reactions of the organism to an act of will. You know very well, you can lie in bed and say, I must get up, and the body can say, yes, you must get up. If you listen very carefully, you'll find funny dialogues going on inside the body. I must get up, yes, you must get up, it's 6:30, yes, it is, isn't it? Meanwhile, the lids are closing firmly. This is tamas. It is a fact that inside the body there is a tendency to try to dominate the body, and there's a reaction from the body. And it is the relation between this will and this inertia that produces all the reactions within here, which obscure the essentially balanced nature of the self. Now, if we take any rotating force, when the force's rotation is established, we call it a being. This is actually the old form of the letter B as a consonant. And then it's cut in half, like this, and then one half of it is rotated on the other, and we get our modern letter B. The Hebrew form of it is like this, because they were living in tents. That represents the earth, this is the wind catcher, and this is the roof. So when the wind is going that way, that means a house, a bed, English word booth, to a Hebrew. We're using the pure geometry of the circle to express to be. To be means to be circumscribed. There is no being other than circumscription. But the moment that a thing exists as a rotating being, and there is another one coming in contact with it, then the impact of the two together produces a ripple inside the substance of both of them. Now, this ripple is called the vritti, the Sanskrit word for it, and it continuously goes through and covers up the essential nature, the clearness, the light of the self. So it means that behind every physical activity we've got, behind every mental activity, every intellectual activity, there is a self which is lit by its own consciousness, which is essentially itself, not merely attributed to it, But the self is principle of sentiency. And yet action obscures it. So the self cannot get lost. But we must scrub out all these reactions within the senses. And if we can remove from the mind all the reactions caused by sense activity, then we can see the true essence of the self. The whole of the technique for doing so consists in these steps we have outlined before. We said that we have five sense organs giving messages to a mind. This is referred to the intellect. And when the intellect reacts back and believes it has focus in the external world, an object which was stimulating one of the five senses, then we have a highly complex situation. There is an assumed substantial object outside there. I assume a light. In fact, that light outside is a construct. My retina has been stimulated by something or other, which I interpret and name as light. Inside the mind, behind the retina, is the mind stuff, which vibrates. So there comes a stimulus, sense organ, a vibration goes into that mind. The mind itself vibrates right through, setting up associations. This is referred, another vibration, to the intellect. The intellect then sends a message back to the mind. So, when I look at that, I say light. The word light vibrates, and I say light visual, not light weight. The intellect has said not light weight, light visual. And then it focuses again on the object. So there's an incoming action and a reaction and a determination of the nature, and over here is the self. And the whole of this mixture is presented to that self. Now, all of it is material except the self. So the whole of this process here is a mixture of action and reaction. And in order to determine objective reality, as opposed to subjective, we have to learn to distinguish between the nature of the stimulus, the nature of the mental reaction, the effect on the intellect, how the intellect determines what it is, and then the reaction into the external world. So, if we were to look at the equivalent analysis in the Indian philosophy, we'd see sound, meaning and knowledge. Well, these are the three. The sound is the external stimulus. The meaning is the nerve motion in the brain. The knowledge is the reaction that occurs to it. So, meaning means what is between. It's the middle. Between this external stimulus and this internal reaction from the knowledge self is meaning, the nerve impulse. Now, from first principles, we know that these three occur together and yet are not identical, and therefore they can be separated out. It means that if we concentrate very, very hard on the external object and deliberately look at it without allowing any reaction whatever in the mind, then, instead of getting a highly complex image of it, which is largely determined by memory, we see a pure stimulus. In the case of the retina one, we see nothing except a zone of colour or tone. You know that a baby, when it's first born, cannot tell that the moon is far away. It sees a light and it puts its hand out. And because its arm, when stretched out, doesn't touch it, it learns that it is farther than its arm. But it doesn't know how far. So, in order for a baby to understand what is the meaning of three-dimensional space, it has to feel the stretching of the arm, the relation of the bones, and then coordinate them in the mind. And then it derives a concept of distance and relates this to the visual impression. You know how difficult it is to thread a needle with only one eye if you put the needle at right angles to the line of vision. Close one eye and then try to thread it. You miss it by an inch or something like that. That will convince you that if you had only one eye, you'd have extreme difficulty, using only a visual sense, to determine the depth of reality, objective. By means of two eyes and converging them, we feel the strain in the eye, and we coordinate this with the sense of touch. And then internally, the eye strain, the convergence of the eye, and the extension of the arm are added up and give a sense of a three-dimensional visual world. Whereas physiologically, we know that we have no concept from the eye of three dimensions at all. The eye only sees colours and tones. So inside here, we have a highly complex relation. Supposing I draw in here, for the moment, a centre and say that is a memory centre. And I look at the electric light, stimulus hits me in the eye, vibrates on the nerves, reacts in the mind substance, and stimulates all previous stimuli of the same order, that is light stimuli. It then rouses them all up and presents the mixture back, and the intellect says that stimulus now coming in is like, in some degree, those other stimuli previously experienced, and therefore I bring with me the memories of those things in order to recognize that thing. Recognition means making again, to fit, making a cog out of that stimulus, putting it in here and mixing it with something already known. Now, if we can trap the impulse as it comes in and don't allow it to go into the memory zone at all, then we can evaluate it exactly as it is. We find the concept of the snake and the rope, or the shell and silver being mixed up. You see a snake in the dark in an eastern country, and fear, the primary fear of death, stimulates out of all wiggly lines, this is a snake. It's better to be mistaken in believing a rope to be a snake and run away, rather than believe the snake to be a rope and be killed. So inside there, all wiggly things are related to fear impulses. So that if we don't break the memory off, we cannot conquer fear. Memory is full of ancestral fears. So, the isolation of memory is an essential part of understanding these three different modes. The intellect derives from primary geometrical concepts certain modes of judgment which it applies to the stimuli and the reactions in the mind. In Plato's terms, there is a world of pure form. This is the world of a priori reasoning. That pure form is eternal geometrical impulsations. We drew it a week or two ago with the compasses as a series of interpenetrating circles. Infinite space is full of impulsations interpenetrating. If you call it a polyspheroidal space, and we represent it on a flat surface by simply putting all the circles and making them intersect and covering the whole paper with such circles, and the intersection of the circles is a point of reference within it, and the whole thing is the mesh out of which Moses was taken. Moses in a Hebrew lexicon means taken out of the waters. Really, it means taken out of the mesh. Moshe means he has become aware of the nature and the mesh of the prakriti, of the material world, and he realizes that this material world is action only, and that it is nothing but action of body and mind that is obscuring the essential light of the soul. So when we contemplate the geometrical analysis of being, in spite of the fact that we haven't seen it yet in the five senses, we are reasoning a priori before the fact, and we are inserting our conclusion through here. This is knowledge. So Plato would say that falling in love is caused by an experience in the past, involved into the being, so that when the being is looking outside and something with fairly regular features comes along, then the primary geometry of the human form divine is stimulated, and a little partial bit of that geometry is enough to trigger off the whole of this force into appearing in the mind, whereupon the girl looks very beautiful. And this was the method whereby Plato explained how love occurs, and we have to distinguish between this a priori basis of it, which is purely geometrical. On another occasion we'll construct a human being with the compasses and show how the true human being is proportioned. And when you see those proportions, you derive pleasure. When an external individual has some of those proportions, the few that are like it stimulate it, and the whole lot tends to come forward, and thus overlay the external stimulus with the result of falling in love. There is another way of doing it, where the collective experiences of the race, not of the macrocosmic, but of the race within the macrocosmic, a race of beings travelling round in their own evolutionary cycle, adds up all the sexual experiences of the male, all the sexual experiences of the female, and involves them as instinctive preferences. Gurdjieff would have called this the polarity of type. If your ancestors have had a lot to do happily with a certain physical type, then there is a response when that type is represented to you from outside. And this conditions your relation with other people. So you'll find yourself with a biological preference. Some people love blondes, some love brunettes, some like them short, some like them tall. All these are the collective experiences of the race involved into your tissue. And yet, we can separate out the external stimulus from the nerve reaction and from the knowledge element. And when we separate these three things out, then we can control our reaction. First, we have to train ourselves to observe the gross fact, the stimulus that comes on the eye, and be quite determined that you're going to see exactly what it is before you rush into a reactive relation. So, if we now consider this threefold thing again, the stimulus, that, and the involved knowledge and the reaction, we have to cut the three and look very hard with full concentration on the gross stimulus on the sense organ. We have to listen critically, we have to look critically and be determined that we shall see what there is, not something that we've got to say about it. Now, if we can see exactly what there is without any contribution whatever from us, that is objective knowledge. If we can see the universe exactly as it is, namely a system of vibratory spheres interpenetrating, that is objectivity. That is purana, the concrete whole of the universe. This is the kind of objectivity that all the sages go for. And it resolves itself down into a series of tropistic and taxic relations between complex structures of material entities. And on the other side of the material entities is only the immaculate self, which never got into trouble in any case. So when we can be absolutely sure that the external fact is seen by us, we have actually inhibited the mental reaction for the time being and shifted our centre of awareness onto the organ itself. You can do this with your own eye. If you look at the situation, if I look at the frame of the picture over there, at first it looks to me three-dimensional. Then I remember that it can't look three-dimensional to my eye, because my eye is really a very, very simple little surface with little rods and cones pointing, that light is hitting them and releasing a stimulus. So what I've really got is a little dot pattern there, the rods and cones of my eye being stimulated by the impact of these light waves reflected onto the picture and hitting me. When I remember that, I know that the three-dimensionalness doesn't belong to my eye at all. And I look at it very carefully, and then quite suddenly it goes flat. And at that moment, it becomes a pure, objective, visual impression. Now, sometimes this happens to people without them knowing why. Children have it happen to them quite often, and sometimes they ask the parents, and say, "Why have you gone flat?" And the parents don't know. And sometimes it will say, "Why have you gone small?" Because quite suddenly, the part of the retina where an image is on can be isolated. And if the consciousness of the child doesn't want to know about it, it suddenly spreads over the whole surface, and the result is a reduction of the image relatively to a very, very tiny figure. I had children say to me, why are you going small? I heard them say this to their parents, and their parents just think they're being silly. But they're not. It means that the consciousness is suddenly spread round the zone where the image is, on the retina, and including the whole of the retina, which is made terrific. Walking past the ear goes, and immediately ancestral images rush through of delightful times in old Egypt, recognizing this perfume, and images are conjured up, and instead of smelling the real chemical content of that smell, you don't smell any such thing. You smell the whole harem and all the delights that go with it. And that is an imposition from inside onto the external situation, and is subjective. It has come from this end. So the objective is simply that real stimulus there, viewed as it is, without any contribution whatever from inside your own mind. Now, the next thing to do is, when you've taken that, ignore the external thing and look at the reaction in your mind, at the nerve reaction. This is a lot harder to do, because the tendency of the mind is to flow outwards, and to make the mind flow back, we use the symbol of the salmon for that. He's jumping up the falls. He's got to get up there. Now, inertia, a twig, goes down the stream very, very easily. The salmon, one of the early symbols of the Christian Trinity, with the fool and the goose, means that jumping up against inertia. If you can force the attention back along this line, you can come to a point where you actually perceive the reaction in the mind stuff itself. When you do this, a very funny thing happens. A stimulus comes, you cut it off, and at the same moment there's a change of tempo in the mind, and you suddenly see a nerve impulse running along the groove. It looks quite long because of this focal range of consciousness itself. And it runs along until it comes to a little gap, like a crossroads, a synapse. And when it gets to that gap, it suddenly makes a light. You know, when the current jumps a gap, there is a little spark. There's a light, and in the light, in the synapse, there's an image. And that image comes from memory, which is in the mind stuff. You actually see an impulse run along, say there's a nerve, and then it finishes like this, and then the next nerve begins. It runs along there like a little ball, it's an impulse. When it comes here, it jumps, and there's a little glow all around the synapse, and inside that glow is an image of your dear old mother or something. And it fades, but you've got plenty of time to see it when you have isolated this thing. You then see your mind stuff's contributions to the external stimulus, and you see it in isolation. When we concentrate on an object, that's the dharana, we are doing. When we continuously do so in this zone, that's dhyana, and when we move backwards into this zone, this is the samadhi. We are going back into the seed condition, where this macrocosmic sphere, which contains all possibilities of knowledge, whatever, can now be seen in its purity. We go behind the mental reaction, having gone behind the stimulus, and we come to the pure geometrical sphere, which contains all formal possibilities, whatever, non-serialized in simultaneity. And we then see that what happens when the stimulus hits the mind, when the mind reacts, is that there is a resonance created by the mind's reactions, and a universal statement which supplies the category into which this will be fitted is made and comes forward into the mind. So we have a junction point here. There is the end of the manas. Here is the intellectual sphere. And where these two meet is the zone called ahankara, the egoic consciousness. If we turn the image upside down a bit, there's the diagram we want, see. Now, this is an archaic symbol, and it means the intellectual sphere, the monastic limit, top, the monastic limit, bottom, the five senses, and the intersection point is the egoic center. Now you can see why the Buddhists deny reality to the egoic centre, when the definition of it is that it is the intersection point of the intellect with the high point of manas. Because as the whole of this is on the material side, and every material being is a composite being, then the ego itself must be a compound. Every compound is subject to dissolution, therefore the egoic consciousness cannot be immortal. So the thing that you refer to at first, for a few years, when you say I, is really a complex of material activities. The real I is not any such thing. We would have to represent that like that. That's the observer. Now this is the self, the Purusha. All these really are inside this self. It has made for itself a sphere. Inside that sphere it has made itself a monastic limit and has ejected five senses. I say ejected because in the growth from an ape to a human being you can actually observe, say in the structure of the eye, in the way there is an extension from the tissues. These senses are pushed out and folded over. If you look at the changes in the development of the organs in developing embryo, you will see just how internal forces are causes and the external forms are effects. The cause is inside and pushes always out. This is the meaning of Christ saying the kingdom of heaven is within. The fine causes are inside and the external effects, like the body and so on, come afterwards. The yogic image is the oyster. The soft part of the oyster inside. And you're going towards the effect, not the cause. So in searching for causes, we must look inside ourselves. The kingdom of heaven is within. Heaven means equilibrated power, and the balance, the centre of power, is internal. So now we know what it means, subjective and objective. It is objective when you, yourself, make no contribution whatever to it, from your memory or any previous experience. And it is subjective when you make contributions from within. A few weeks ago we did romantic and classic. We can see then in this sense that when a contribution is made from inside, out, onto the object, that would correspond with the romantic concept. Because we'd be adding things from our mind and our emotions and covering up the external fact, and that would be romantic. Whereas if we came to measure the object accurately, we will always find it reduces to a very simple geometrical relation. Namely, contact, as the Bhagavad Gita says, all the trouble comes from the contact of the senses. Bodies outside hit bodies here and cause vibrations inside. This is the coarsest part, the outside, and as you go in, it's going finer and finer and finer until you come to the very finest centre of the will, and immediately behind that will, which is the point of initiation, is the true self, which does nothing whatever except look. But the looking is a catalyst and causes things to happen. So if we wanted to measure the universe properly in a mathematical way, we would actually construct the classic view of Greek temple architecture, which was all of it derived from the fact of the partition of the circle. If you go over the classic Greek temples, you'll find they're entirely geometrical in structure, like the Greek vases. And there is no contribution whatever from the emotions or the personal experience ideas of the architect. He's not interested. The Greek architect was interested only in representing a universal truth in his temple structures. So he used a compass and straight edge and built himself such a temple. If you take a pair of compasses and mull it over an elevation of any of the Greek temples, you find everything falls where it should fall geometrically. And therefore, to be objective in this sense is ultimately to be geometric. We're then coming down to primary facts. We'll reduce it now to biological level. There's an amoeba. It's in a fluid. We drop a little bit of lemon juice there. It spreads out and it begins to bite. And at that point, the amoeba feels pain and it alters its shape. And it begins to draw back from that point. And we call that a negative taxism. It is moving away from the source of the stimulus. We then drop a little bit of food here that spreads out in the water, stimulates it, and there's a pseudoproduct, prolongation of the tissue, and it goes round that, and the whole thing flows towards it, and then envelops the food inside it. We call that a positive taxism. Now, to know that an amoeba reacts like that is no good to us unless we know that every single cell in our body, which has a nucleus in it, has an intelligence. That nucleus is the brain of that cell, and it responds exactly like that amoeba. If you touch it and hurt it, it will tend to shrink away. If you titillate it and give it a pleasure stimulus, it will want to go towards it. So you can actually cause a man to feel in bits by giving him painful and pleasurable stimuli in certain orders, and he'll tend to go towards it and away from it. And in that moving towards and away from, you'll find this dither and shake, because he cannot resolve the problem. And the only way to resolve it is to reduce the thing down to a question of what is pleasure and what is pain. You see that in the pain is the A-I-N, the grip of refusal, the pain. Pain is that which you refuse, and you refuse it because you cannot assimilate it. Which means to say that at the point where you can actually train yourself to assimilate a situation, which before you couldn't, at that point, what was painful is now no longer painful. And when you can assimilate it very, very easily at your leisure, it is then called pleasure. So the idea of pleasure is that you can assimilate the energy of the stimulus. The idea of pain is that the stimulus comes at you too vigorously or too quickly. Now if I draw a simple version of a monocell, and I put a stimulus that's very, very strong for it, so that it vibrates it a lot here, the actual fact is that the force of the stimulus pushes that being away. So that being sentient, experiences a high degree of revulsion for the stimulus. But the stimulus has actually pushed it away. You see that in the case of a baby. If you go to a baby and clap your hands loud near it, he jerks his head away, its eyes blink, and you have shocked it. The impulse hitting the unprepared child actually jolted the nerves and immediately ran into the muscle structures and jerked the head away. Now, the mature person has to teach himself to assimilate any kind of stimulus whatever, and then he can no longer be shocked. The idea is to reach a level where you can maintain perfect equilibrium. In order to do so, you have to remind yourself that the self is eternal, is not composite, and in no sense is touched by the stimuli. If you identify with the body, which is made of these rotations, when a stimulus comes and vibrates the body, you will become afraid. But if you train yourself to say this is merely a vibration of a body in consciousness, then you will not become afraid, and the body is then open. Instead of contracting against the stimulus, it expands. And then it accepts the energy of the stimulus inside itself, and the stimulus then loses the name pain, because it has now not been diffused, it's been taken in. Christ being crucified on purpose means this. You take the worst conceivable suffering and you deliberately say, if I drive myself to accept the worst suffering, then I shall be able to accept all other sufferings because they'll be considerably less. So the idea of deliberately being nailed up on the cross, which is again a symbol of these intersecting forces, is the idea of taking the one thing which would be hardest to assimilate. This is the meaning of the meditation in the garden. Can I take it? See, this is matter, this is spirit. Can we take the agitations of the material world and assimilate them to the spirit? The answer is we can, by training ourselves by degrees, to take shots. It doesn't matter how small they are. My brother and I used to do it by hanging up wet cloths in the doorway in the dark, so that anybody walking through a doorway could suddenly be slapped in the face. This is one of the kiddies. And if you didn't shout, you were considered to have been fairly ready. And we devised all different ways of trying to catch each other off guard. And the result was that we derived a certain amount of benefit from the practices. We were able, when a stimulus came, immediately to respond and say, that is a stimulus hitting the body, and the body is not the self, and therefore let it vibrate. And the moment that was happened, the body no longer contracted with the fear, the energy came in, the body expanded, and you had actually gained energy then. The stimulus feeds you when you can assimilate it. Whereas, if you react against and try to kick things out, you starve yourself. So, this is the meaning of the egoic statement. If a man tries to preserve his egoic consciousness against a stimulus, he will shrink it and tighten it. And in so doing, he can get progressively smaller. So if he tries to preserve his egoic life, he will lose it. But if he understands the meaning of that diagram we had before, he'll know that that ego, in any case, taking the stimulus, is nothing except an intersection between a cosmic universal and an individual mind. And therefore, he will say, well, that isn't the self, or is internal to the self. The self is not disturbed, but it is the body which is disturbed, and therefore let the body vibrate. And without any contraction at all, when the body is perfectly opened, whatever is the character of the stimulus given down here, then this thing will expand. Perfect love casts out fear. If we understand this relation, love is a kind of relation working for the development of the potentialities of the being. If we understand the relation of that and the utility of it to us, then we will allow shocks progressively more and more vigorous as we become more and more aware of the real meaning of the material inside the self. So now we have a good indicator about what to do in the case of our single cell and the groups of cells, the organs in the body, and how to control them. You know that every organ in your body is specialized for a particular function. And each group of cells making an organ definitely wants to do precisely what it's doing. Some of them want to eat, some want to drink, some want to run about, some like to listen, some like to look. The lust of the eye is not simply a metaphor. The eye actually enjoys stimulation. So it looks for it. So a red dress going down the road on a certain kind of figure, you don't need to say, I observe, the eye has already observed. Because there is a lust of the eye, and there's a lust of the ear. Ears like listening to beautiful sounds, beautiful sonatas and so on. So we have to realize that every group of cells has its own appetite. And when we then consider the body of a human being as a threefold structure with a coordinating spinal column, we then see that we have a large group of cells that delight in thinking. As soon as a man has gone to a pub and put in the hole in his face something to satisfy the tamasic region down there, so that the belly is now delighted with digesting, all the belly cells, they don't care about religion and politics, they're guzzling away down there, and as long as he puts the arm up and pulls it down, they go on merrily and merrily. Meanwhile, up here comes Rajas. I must prove to this fellow that I am a true conservative, and so on. So this department goes on enjoying the conversation. This one keeps sending messages up to the arm, put another pipe down. Meanwhile, here is something quite different, an emotional relation, that says, I like this fellow I'm talking to, even though he doesn't agree with me. Or, alternatively, I don't like this fellow, even though he's a brother conservative. So the emotional relation is having its own way. It might even be looking at somebody at another table while it's talking very seriously about the ethical problems of the world to a fellow on this table. And this is the departmental nature of body reactions. So each little cell in the body, because it's got a membrane around it, isolating it means that it is an entity in its own right. And when we consider the whole man, we call each one of these little ones, wherever there is a division in the body, we call it a sub-entity. Subent for short. So we say every subent has got a consciousness and a will of its own. It has a formal heritage. It tends to do certain things formally, and it has its own will to do them. So it has an intellect, its formal content, and it has volition of its own, and it has affection. It likes and it dislikes. So this means that the whole of the body itself is like a peculiar form of society with intellectuals in it, and emotionalists, and guzzlers. And this is the human society. And all the relations of human beings in all nations at all times historically are simply the working out of the inherent relations of the parts of an individual human being. There cannot be, for a human being, in society, anything other than already exists in himself. There must be an intellectual being laying down the law. There must be guzzlers in the pubs insulting it without knowing how to do it, complaining about the taxation on the beer. There must be emotionalists and sentimentalists saying, wouldn't it be nice if, and why can't we be kind to each other, and so on. So here is the true social relationship expressed in man. It's for this reason that we say man is the microcosm. He is the little universe. Society is a bit bigger universe, and the whole universe itself is a big man. That big man is the Adam Kadmon of the Kabbalists. Adam Kadmon is a universal man with his three parts. And it is the same as the Trinity of God. There is the compassion of God, and there is the will of God, and there is the Logos, the reason of God, and that is the Trinity. So in the individual human being, we find everything that we find outside in the universe. Now, in order to control it, we have to use the coordinating function of the spinal nerves. And we have to become aware, as we did in the case of the three levels, sense stimulus, mental reaction, and intellectual determination about it. So in the same way, most sense stimuli for ordinary men have to do with appetite down here. So we say that corresponds with this. And this corresponds with the intellect. So this part is the reactive part of the emotion. This is where we say we experience meaning, in the middle. And we said before that the sense part down here that's running us into the world always runs us into an experience which is either pleasant or painful. We said if it was pleasant, we put a plus in this side, then there was an immediate release of further energy into the same experience. And no energy ever rose higher than this line in the chest. As soon as the reaction becomes pleasant, it turns down again into the world and does it again and again and again, as long as it remains pleasant. And therefore, a being of will on a pleasure pursuit, if he succeeded, would always be running back into the world and would never, ever need to think. But in fact, we find that when the will impulse runs into a situation, sometimes it registers pain and negation. And the moment there is pain, the energy goes up the spine into the head and becomes thought. And you see the meaning of the crucifixion of Christ now. That if we don't face painful situations, we will never think. And if we don't think, we will never discover the rules of action and reaction governing the body. So it means we must really, if we desire to get cosmic intellection, to gain absolute intelligence, if we desire it, we must look for the painful situation. But we said before that if the situation is a similar one, it is no longer painful. It means to say that situations that would have been painful to you, at the moment you are prepared to embrace them, knowing they will cause you to think, then the whole qualitative relationship between you and the situation changes, with the result that what would have previously been painful becomes less and less painful and less valuable for thought. And then you have to devise more and more difficult situations. Because if you don't devise more difficult situations for you to go into, you won't get to the highest thought. Christ had to devise for himself the supreme difficulty of provoking all the organized synagogues, leaders, to nail him up. If he couldn't have got them to nail him up in that manner, he couldn't have got the very highest cosmic thought of universal sacrifice. other people who say, well, I'll just dry myself a little bit. I'll speak to that charming lady at the bus stop and offer to lend her my umbrella. You see, now that's very, very painful to do because she might be rude to me. So he goes like this and she suddenly says, thank you very, very much. And before he knows what's happened, she smiles, pleasure arises, and he's holding it over even more. So that he gets quite wet trying to cover her up with his umbrella. And it keeps telling to go around this way. So you have to devise situations that for you are difficult. And every man has to use his own intelligence to discover what is difficult for him. And really, it's a measure of your acquired intelligence, which means previous suffering, the nature of the test you will devise for yourself. And we had our universal principle, subject to the law that you must not destroy the organ of your experience. You should push it as far as you can into the most painful situations you can. This is the meaning of the mortification of the flesh. When a pleasure stimulus comes, the organism flows towards it. When a pain one comes, it flows away from it. Now, if we don't mortify the flesh, it will always do that. Mortify simply means let's kill it. And let's establish the substance ought in it. Death, that's a nice German word meaning place. And you see that it's an anagram of the rota again. And that only rotation of forces establishes place. But if you remain in the place forever, you are mort. You are substantially localized. So the man who never moves out of his place is really dead. In the New Testament, it distinguishes between the quick and the dead. The dead are all those people in the groove going round and round and round the same old routine, and they are mort. And a mortal being is one that can be put in a groove and left there. And an immortal one is a man with the power to get out of any groove situation that he gets into. So, every subent in the body has its own peculiar threefold nature. It has form in it from your ancestors, which determines its activity's type. It has volition in that determines the urge level. And it has sentience in it. It feels pleasures and pains. And unless you mortify it, that is, unless you determine the location of its substance and say, if it's down there, it's to do with appetite. If it's up here, it's to do with emotion. If it's up here, it's got to do with reason. In fact, if we find a person being very, very sick and we find a symptom at a certain level in the spine, the level in which it occurs gives us a key to the cause of the disease. The energy from below is always pushing up here to try to conquer the intellect. This is the primary urge. The intellect is always pressing down here in order to conquer this urge and make it orderly. And when they meet, they should resolve on the line of the heart, where refined feeling would say what the urge is permitted to do and what the intellect is permitted to impose as a limit. So if everything resolves on the middle line, it is all right. But if we find a symptom appearing above the middle line, say down the larynx, in the case of thyroid cases and so on, the impulse from below has driven itself over the proper resolution line and is threatening to enter the intellectual centre. So we see a high degree of volitional excitement in those cases where symptoms appear over the centre line. So if we find TB in the lungs here, we know that there's an emotional problem because the urge is climbing up. We find in TB cases an increase of sexual activity. And so on the other hand, if the intellectual power is so great, as it's a negation power, negating the urge, it presses down and we find the symptom appearing below the middle line, say around the stomach. And then the stomach begins to feel depressed because the intellect is forcing the will below the resolution level. If it goes right down here, we find all sorts of disorders of the lower intestines. So the level of the symptom tells you the cause. If it is above, it means a triumph of the urge over the intellect. If it is below the resolution line, the intellect has been pushing the will too far down. And that is tamas, that is rajas, and along this line of resolution is sattva. So it is in the feeling that increased sensitivity is required. The feeling is the key to the true self. The self is the only sentient, the only intelligent. And matter, prakriti and all its evolutes, are not intelligent or sentient at all. They only appear so through association with the self. Now, have we got any particular questions arising out of this that might be dealt with?
I've understood you then, there's the ordinary loose use of the words objective and subject, subjective experiences. Really, very few people have a pure objective or subjective experience.
Yes, very few.
It's only a matter of stress.
Yes, yes. Objectivity you would tend to find at certain times of the day in certain occupations. For instance, an engineer, say a radio engineer or an engineer dealing with large engines, has to be objective during the course of his work. But simply because being objective in that sense has caused a tension in a part of his organism. When he goes out, he starts being very subjective. You notice that the calendars in engineers' offices are all covered in luscious leaves. They're famous for the rudeness of their calendars because their objective activities are starving the other end of their being. So that this balance is the most important thing. See, a person with the wrong conception of mortification would say it means, oh, destroy the body. We said it doesn't. It means put everything in its proper place. This is all the substance in its right place. The right thing in the right place at the right time. Trousers on, in Piccadilly, off, at home, perhaps. You have to decide where you are, what you are, who you're with, and so on. And resolve it on the middle line with feeling. It's on this middle line that the aesthetic consciousness is placed. This is the line of sensitivity and gentlemanly behaviour. This is the line that says exactly when, where, and how something can be got away with. If you're deficient in feeling, either the urge or the intellect will impose. But if you feel very, very carefully and you have what is called good taste, then you will know just precisely how much urge you could afford to let loose in that moment. And you know that the objective and the subjective are two sides of the absolute. And therefore they must be given their due. You render to Caesar, the material world, what is due to it, and to God, the true spiritual self, what belongs to that. So if you give the devil his due, that is the material parts of the body, then you can give the self its due also. Whereas if you deprive either of them of what is properly due to them, you will have trouble.
Suppose you are able generally to view a certain type of stimulus objectively, and yet occasionally you appear to be affected subjectively, and also you appear to be affected subjectively on different levels. Why does that happen?
Well, you made a slip of the tongue then, didn't you? You said affected instead of affected.
Affected.
You noticed, didn't you?
Yes.
Well, you were saying that sometimes it is more affective. It affects the other person more if you are subjective rather than objective. See, that word that came out was not an error in the sense of not applying to the statement. It was the truth. People do find subjective behaviour frequently more effective. And the emotional nature is called affective, isn't it? So if you wish to affect another person, you're better off on the emotional level. So, frequently a child, if you corner it about whether it's been stealing all the sawdust out of the strawberry jam or something, instead of it giving you an objective reply, it looks at you horribly, turns the corner of its mouth down and cries. Now that is a device. A child, quite consciously, children are very wise, will put you off with an emotional display rather than give you an objective statement of what happened. Now adults grow up with this thing. And so they tend not to be objective where being objective wouldn't fulfill the purpose. So if being objective doesn't help, they'll suddenly say, my God, I can't stand this, which is a subjective demonstration. So really what you're talking about and what is the answer to your question is this. sometimes you have found in your experience that it doesn't pay to be objective with other people. That is, you have more effect by being subjective. Really, subjectivity is the lady's way, isn't it? And objectivity is the intellectual man's way. And the Tao Te Ching says it's a clever man who can be a man and yet remain a woman. That is, you can objectively see what you want and still go at it subjectively.
I wonder whether it
had
anything to do with being that, in relation to memory or something like that.
Well, of course it had, because the whole of your memory is stocked with your successes and failures in previous experience. So when a given stimulus comes to you, you rake about in the memory for the correct reaction. If when you were a child, an emotional reaction gave you what you wanted, you'll bring it out. And if an emotional reaction got you nowhere, you'll be terribly logical. I know a man the other day who was caught by his 6-year-old son, whom he'd been teaching to think reasonably. And then the father had a toothache, and he became a little bit irrational. And the son said, "Daddy, you are not being logical." And at that moment, the father felt awful. And instead of gathering himself together and saying, "No, I am not being logical, I have a toothache, it has irritated me, and I have been triggered into a wrong relation," he became very subjective. He said, "Do not talk in that manner to your own father." And that was a subjective statement. Nevertheless, the child knew that his father was at fault. So he just went away and chalked one out. So you have to evaluate and realize the strange thing about the powers that derive from certain exercises. It is said that when you can be objectively truthful, you can produce effects without having to work for it. Now, it's worth meditating on. If you can be objectively truthful, you can produce effects without having to work for it. Now, that is a hint that's given. It's not recommended to write down the full implications of it. But if you meditate on it and find out what it means, then if you are objectively truthful, things will happen without you having to work for them. Then there is a benefit to be derived from it. To every exercise, there is a corresponding increase of power.
When you view the thing objectively, you don't get the sort of flux that you get, energy flux that you get if you're subjective.
Not at all. If you view it objectively, you will be free from it. And if the other person is not viewing it objectively, he will not be free from it. And if you are free and he isn't at that moment, then as Nietzsche said, the whip is in your hands. And whether you use it or not depends on whether the whip towers.
When you say you rake about in the memory for the previous experience, really if you're progressing in this work, you would not do that.
If you're progressing in this work, you've already done that, only consciously. You deliberately rake about instead of accidentally raking about and say, "What would be my usual reaction to such and such a stimulus?" Well, I remember my old grandmother used to cough like mad at that point, so I'll cough like mad and see what happens. Now, little kiddies do this sort of thing. About a couple of months ago, I was asked to go and see a woman with a terrible chest, which had come upon her very, very suddenly. She'd been diagnosed as having an attack of bronchitis. Who practically drove her voice away and made her sound really awful. Under light hypnosis, induced by herself, after a few verbal suggestions to her how to do it, she suddenly remembered her grandmother doing it, and that it was her grandmother's method of dictating to the whole family. As soon as anything went wrong, grandmother had an attack and made the most horrible noises, and they did anything whatever to stop the noises, and then order was restored. And she had done this on her poor hubby. She then became very, very ashamed, and 10 minutes afterwards there wasn't a sign of a symptom. It was all gone. She just contracted internally the whole of the breathing tube, like Grandma used to do. And it makes a horrible noise when you do it deliberately. And it imposes on everybody. I think terrible things are going to happen. That's a subjective trick. And yet it has an objective side if you do it physically.
Babies will turn themselves maybe black to them.
Oh yes, yes. Sometimes babies will put their heels and the backs of their heads on the ground and arch themselves and go perfectly rigid so you can pick them up by the ankles without them altering their position. And it's just the will to impose on you. And if you give in, they'll keep doing it when they're old. Sometimes grown ladies do, and they can't get their own way. It's then called a hysterical symptom. Babies do it long before sexual activities arise. It's simply the will to dominate the situation by a subjective trick. I think one of the worst crimes in the world, next to dog in a manger, is emotional blackmail, which people practice on each other all the time. They look at each other reproachfully. You see, and then everybody feels terrible. And you've got to be very, very objective to take a reproachful look and do nothing about it. And yet the whole of the rules, the theories, and the knowledge of the practices do you no good at all unless you actually practice them yourself in material situations. Like stealing somebody's seat on a bus.